This is Music Respawn. I'm Kate Remington with Gareth Coker, and I have so been looking forward to talking with you about your music for Halo Infinite, and here we are, finally. This is great.
You can't get rid of me. I feel like it was only a few months ago we were talking about Ark, but this might be the last one for a while. I go a little bit quieter on the games front for a while. So, but yeah, glad to be here to talk about Halo.
Oh, this is just incredible. How did you get attached to the team of composers?
So I got an email in my inbox from Joel Yager, the music supervisor, and I had no idea who he was at the time. And it just said, would you be interested in working on a project with us? And I'm like, okay, well, that's not, doesn't tell me very much. But at the bottom, I see on the email signature 343 Industries. And well, they only make one game. So I was like, okay, well, this is clearly a Halo pitch. And then my audition for Halo was actually the trailer that aired at E3 2019, like literally the whole thing.
Wow.
So it was like a six minute video. I wasn't required to do everything from it, but I did all of it because I wanted to impress.
Sure.
So Curtis was already involved. Like Curtis actually did the version of that trailer that aired, but the pitch was I was doing the same thing that Curtis was doing, so it was actually kind of interesting to see if I was in the same ballpark or not, and it turned out that I was pretty close. So I obviously did a good job on the pitch, and here we are. Interestingly, the reason I was even considered for the project, most people would come to the conclusion that I was involved because of Ori. It's actually not the case at all. The thing that Joel and the other key creative audio stakeholders noticed was actually my work on Ark, especially some of the more science fiction elements that are in the soundtrack, but also the use of tribal rhythms in Ark, which obviously has big crossover with Halo. Now, of course, my work on Ori helps, especially because it's another Microsoft game, so I'm sure that didn't like hurt my my audition. But it meant that they, you know, they had someone who could kind of deliver the whole range of things that they needed for a game as big as Halo.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I remember talking with Gordy Hab about one of his early Star Wars soundtracks, and he said to get the right feel for that. He went back to the source material that John Williams had borrowed from, like The Planets by Gustav Holst. So what did you do to get, you know, kind of cherry pick from various things to make sure that you were on the right page with, you know, the sound of a Halo soundtrack?
Literally exactly that, like the same process. It's the first time I've done a sequel on a project which I didn't create the musical identity. So that's very new. Obviously, Ori 2 is a sequel. All of the Ark expansions are sequels, but I also created the musical identities. So it's my musical language. This is someone else's musical language. Marty O'Donnell, Michael Salvatore, Kazuma Jinuchi, Neil Davidge. Like, went back and studied all of it for quite some time. And also went back and played the games and tried to understand, like, why do people like this so much? Like, what is it? Because, you know, when I play a video game, like, yes, I'm aware, like, that the music's good, it's stirring and doing all the right things. But when you actually go and study another game as a composer, you're trying to understand what other people like about it. And there are a couple of things that I landed on, and I know this is consistent with the other composers too. I think one of the most noticeable things about Halo's music, it's as much about the notes, but also about what's not there. The space in between the notes, like the gaps. There's just a great sense of depth and space. Like, it's not relentless, epic music the whole time. And that kind of ties in, to me, to Master Chief's personality. Master Chief, he's seen it all before. Like, nothing phases him. And the music kind of has this steady, unwavering confidence to it. If you notice, a lot of the Halo action music is in a major key. And that's because when Master Chief enters the battlefield and other humans on his side see him, it's a we're going to be okay moment. And then you kind of go do your thing, and Master Chief's basically a badass. He's basically a superhero, especially to the people who respond to seeing him on the battlefield. And that, you can sense that identity right from the very first level of Halo 1. Like, this is a confident soldier. Whereas sometimes, you know, if you drop into a Call of Duty, you know, there's a lot of angst because, you know, as a soldier entering a battlefield there, like, you might be a new soldier. I think Call of Duty World War I did this particularly well. Doom is just, like, manic craziness the whole time. So it makes sense for, like, everything to be over the top. But, like, to me, the music for Halo, it has its stirring moments, but overall, it's like you're steady. This is just another day at the office for Master Chief. And there's a steady confidence to it all that he can handle any situation thrown at him. And that's like the one thing I, like, really, like, focused in on, with the secondary thing being the kind of, like, gaps of silence which allow for, like, a sense of space in the music. And I remember doing my first drafts for my first, like, Halo tracks. They were all overwritten. They were trying too hard. And eventually kind of cut things down and just pressing delete a lot, to be honest. Like, get to the core of, like, what a track actually is. Master Chief is so focused and so, like, clear in what he's going to do that, like, having all of this superfluous stuff in the music doesn't really make sense. Like, you know, that goes right back to the main title theme for Halo, the Monk's Chant. It's literally one group of singers singing a single line. And when you can make one thing that iconic, like, that's what you're kind of trying to do. Like, a lot of the themes presented in Halo, whether it's the old ones or the new ones, they're presented for the first time in a very simple way. Like, Escherim's theme, it's literally just the basses. There's not a lot else going on in the music. Like, we want to make sure that you get that initial motif into your head first, and then we start to develop it.
Thank you.
I can go on for hours like about all these little pieces, but I think you can start to get an idea. It's like it's very, very focused. I think that's why the original Halo music was so successful. It's so focused and tied into Master Chief's character, and that inevitably carries over into the player's psyche when they're playing the game, which I think is the reason why the music is so popular.
Well, and
one
it's,
of the reasons anyway.
Yeah, for sure. And it's so memorable, and there wasn't anything else like it in game soundtracks when it came out, and I think it just really blew everybody away. And when you played it for the very first time, were you even thinking about being a game composer?
No. because that's a good 20 years ago. I mean, I was still in high school. I wasn't really even playing that many first-person shooters. Like, I was more doing the strategy games at the time. But so I got to Halo a little bit later. But when I did get around to playing it, I had started to become like aware of music and film and games and stuff. And I think you just know if you've played games for long enough and have had enough experiences with good and bad and mediocre games, you kind of just know when you're in the hands of something special. You kind of just know after 30 minutes. Like, there's several games I've played, I was like, oh, I can tell this is going to be good, like, all the way through. I can just tell because it feels good to play. Like, the controls aren't janky. All of the art presentation, everything makes sense. The last game I played that I really, really felt that was Psychonauts 2. Like, it is, to me, it's a perfect game. Like, every so often there comes along a game which is so perfectly constructed and everything fits together. There's no cracks on the edges. You can't even see the smoke and mirrors, because there's some games where you can kind of see where they're like hiding things away. And Halo is one of those games. It's a landmark achievement, especially for the time. And so it's, while I wasn't, you know, actively paying attention to the music when I first played it, because I had played it so many years ago, when I did go back and study it, I was like, okay, well, I kind of know like how the levels are going to go down, so I can actually focus on what the music is doing. And I don't know how the music was implemented in Halo 1. It doesn't really matter. But what it felt like to me is that Marty, Michael, whoever implemented the music, it's not dissimilar to how I did Ori 1 and Ori 2. Like, I only say that because the music feels so tightly scripted to what's going on at every moment. Especially, I especially compare that to Ori 2. Like, it's the music is spotted so well. Like, where the music swells and where the music dies away, which is very complicated in a first-person shooter because there's so many variables. Like Ori, it's a lot more straightforward. Where it does what it needs to emotionally, I think that is a skill that really separates composers and music teams in general. Like, because you can't, especially in 2022, you cannot just like dump a bunch of music in the game. Like, that's like the bare minimum. Like, where are you going to have it swell? Where are you going to have it die away? Like, where are you going to like enhance the emotion? Where are you going to have no music at all? Is actually really important. And those decisions, like, I really felt that on especially the original trilogy, they spent so much time like figuring out the absolute best place to drop the music. I think I talked about this with you maybe once on a when I was talking about one of the trailers for World of the Wisps. Like, the very first trailer that we did for Will of the Wisps, Ori comes on screen, and we had a debate in the team, like, should the theme come in when Ori comes in on screen, or should the theme come in when Ori puts his arm around Ku? And the difference between that is only like two and a half seconds, but the feeling is completely different. And you'd think, well, why is 2.5 seconds of difference going to make? But it's how it pairs with the visuals. That's a big part of why music can make people feel what they feel. And yes, 2.5 seconds does actually make a massive difference. And so it felt like on the original Halos that they spent an insane amount of time like deciding exactly where to drop the music. And so that's something I really noticed when playing the game and studying it.
Well, I think they must have. And what's interesting to me about it is that sound goes all the way back to the very first Bungie games, the Myth games that Mike and Marty yep. worked on with, in that case, it was kind of synthy strings, but the percussion was there, and it was like a really important element of the instrumentation. So how did you decide, you know, besides that, what was important to have in the instrumentation?
So yeah, the instrumentation, there's kind of two parts to this question, because I would say the bulk of the Halo score, especially the first 66-70% of the game, it's using the instrumentation that from the Halo that we kind of know. So, you know, it's a decent sized string section, a very modest sound of brass section, nothing compared to my Chaos on Arc, for example. And then the percussion, we actually, because there's so many layers to the percussion, we actually recorded all of the percussion lines individually and then multi-tracked them. So it's all of the drums you hear in the game were recorded by one person.
Wow.
Yeah. Brian Kilgore is the percussionist for the game. And he just has a huge array of drums at his house, and he has a really nice recording room. And actually, you don't need a big studio to record percussion. It's actually kind of nice to have a smaller room, because you get that like slightly more intimate sound. When you put a microphone near a drum, you get more of the attack sound of the drum when the beater hits the drum. Whereas you put it in a big studio, it's going to sound big and epic, but that's kind of not what we want. You lose that precision. And if you listen to the percussion almost across the entire soundtrack for Halo, it's very precise. Focus, there's that word again. And honestly, the choice of drums, we just kind of went back and listened to the material, and it's like, well, what are they using, and let's try and get close to that. I think that's best exemplified in The Road, where I really like, I mean, that's honestly a recreation of a track from the original trilogy, and wow, just trying to find like the exact rhythms and, you know, the exact drums, it's really hard like to match the aesthetic. I mean, for example, let's fast forward 20 years from now and say like RE4 is coming out and I'm not working on it, but someone wants to go back and like they're gonna have to like dive in to like everything and hopefully they've archived everything properly. You really have to go back and listen very, very carefully to like the exact drum sounds they're using. But to me, it's actually less about the sounds. I think you can make any set of drums work. The key is the rhythm, and that sense of tribalism that is kind of almost ever present in the music in a different way. You know, there's I don't want to say the drums for Master Chief are tribal, because they're not, but there is kind of like a constant groove and pulse to them that echoes that confidence that Master Chief has. Whereas the Banished percussion, or the Escherim percussion, is a little bit more, I'm not going to say chaotic, violent is the word I'm looking for. Yeah, the drums are hit just a little bit harder. The drum sounds themselves are a little bit edgier. So whereas, you know, Master Chief, we're using more traditional drums like snare drum or traditional orchestral toms or bass drum, the Escherim and Banished percussion, it's frame drums, which kind of have like nice edge to them, especially when you hit them really hard, because it's stretched, the skin is stretched in a really interesting way across the drum. And the great thing about working with one percussionist is we kind of get to try out a lot of different drums to find out, like, we have an idea going in, like what drums we want to use, but then the percussionist will be like, well, maybe not a 16-inch frame drum. How about an 18-inch frame drum? Because it'll be slightly deeper and also be tuned better to the track. Like, I mean, this is the level of detail that we go to like trying to get the right sound and feel. And yeah, I mean, that's just a little bit about the percussion.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and I love your track The Road, because I was listening in my car and it just popped up. I was like, oh man, I know that.
Yes,
is One Final Effort from Halo 3. And
yep.
Marty told me one time he loves jigs, and that is kind of what that is. But how did you, you know, freshen it up and make it fit the context of Infinite?
That was the hardest track to get finished, because I remember getting assigned it and I'm like, oh great, I got this one. It's like, alongside the Monk's theme, it's the most famous Halo track, I would say. And I was like, great, I'm gonna be a while on this track. And I think actually what makes it, one of the things that just makes it sound different is that my production aesthetic is different to Marty and Michael. That's just a byproduct of, you know, we're in 2022. I have a different education. I have different cultural background. I've had made different choices my whole career. I think the thing that was really interesting is that, you know, when we did that in the studio, we recorded that piece at Air Studios, and we spent a lot of time with the cellos trying to dial in that dug-a-da-dung, dug-a-da-dung, because there are so many ways of playing a motif on a stringed instrument. Think how many ways you can use a bow to play a string, and it's never the exact same every time because of the nature of string bows and how strings react to a bow. And so we just kept on, because it's a short phrase, so we were able to try a lot of things out very quickly. I mean, this is the great thing about having a big budget and a lot of studio time, is you get to try things out. I mean, there is so much material on the cutting room floor that we, you know, threw out because it just didn't feel like Halo. And eventually, you know, we got to a version of it, we were like, that's the sound. It's still a little different to the original, but we're like, that feels like Halo. It's just like, it's a very confident way of playing. The short notes, oh my goodness, short notes. I'm having flashbacks now. So the short notes, the da-ga-da-da, like that da-ga-da, the first three notes, if they're too short, it doesn't work. If they're too long, it doesn't work. It has to be just the right length. And so eventually we found it and we were like, that, bottle that, remember it, because we're probably going to use it elsewhere in the soundtrack as well. One of the cool things about having those players on it, though, is that there is, you know, it just is a way of making things feel more alive. Not that the original doesn't, it just, it's alive in a different way. So we wanted to, you know, obviously we wanted it to sound as close to the original as possible, but it, with the same feeling. I think this is the thing that when you're essentially revisiting old music and, you know, giving it a different coat of paint, you've got to retain the feeling that the original music gave. It could sound completely different, but if it retains the feeling, that's okay. I remember running into this with Ark, because for the first 2 years of Ark, we had the main theme in, and it was a mock-up because we were in early access. And, you know, people got used to that sound. I think it's a really good mock-up, the original digital version of the main theme. And then we went and recorded it at Abbey Road with a 93-piece orchestra, and we put it in the game, and people were not ready for it because they'd gotten used psychologically to how the original mock-up made them feel. Now, after time, it's beyond question that the final version is definitely superior to the mock-up version. It's not even like a contest. But it's also because people have, their brains have adapted to it now. And there is actually a very psychological thing that goes on when you get used to hearing a certain version of a track for so long, you're inevitably going to become attached to it. So when I did The Road, I'm like, it's a huge responsibility because you're not, it's not about just recreating an old track that is loved. You're actually going in and playing with game players' nostalgia and memories. And so if you step too far away from that, you're messing with people's memories. And that's like the last thing I want to do when revisiting such an iconic track. And so that's really what it's all about to me. It's like, can we find the performance that retains the feel but still has an aesthetic that's, you know, matches what we're trying to do for the game in 2021? Man, that was a good answer.
It sure was. Like... Well, you must have had that sound just like really imprinted on your brain so that in the recording studio you would know just when they got it right. So
yeah, I mean we spent a long time on it like before we got to the studio, and so we kind of knew exactly what we were looking for when we got there. We just had to push the musicians to get to that place where we wanted them, because they don't know. Like, they haven't been on the project for, you know, months, years. So it's not fair to expect them to know. So it's our job as composers to educate them, and they're really good musicians, so they can get there pretty quick. And so once you land on that sound, then you're like, that's it. That's the length of the short notes that we want kind of throughout the score. And then they, because it's the same players across all the sessions, they remember that. So... and then style is established over the time that you're recording.
Well, you mentioned that you got assigned that track from Joel Yarger, and so I'm curious how it all were, how he wrangled you and Joe Korlitz and Curtis to, you know, for you all to stay on the same page musically and decide who was going to do what.
So that was another thing that was new to me as well. Like, you know, I've never done a collab before, and I was. Trust me, I was as curious as you are now, how that was going to work. But I think on a project this big with this much going on and like all of the, you know, inevitable politics and stuff like that comes with a Halo project, Joel Yarger was the filter between the composers and 343. Because if we got feedback from like literally everyone that was giving feedback at 343, well, some of it's good and some of it isn't going to be relevant. And Joel was the conduit between 343's audio vision and then the three composers who were contracted to deliver that vision in terms of the music. And it's not uncommon for me to like have a, you know, music supervisor on a project. You know, there's always or an audio director, that someone who I report to. But like this was very good because of the shielding from everything that's going on from 343. And I don't mean that in a negative sense. There's just a lot that goes on in a very big video game with so many people attached to it that you can end up losing focus. It was the same on Ubisoft when I worked on Immortals Fenyx Rising. I reported to one person who acted as the conduit, and you know, that was really nice. It's just there was only one composer on that, so it was like, okay, well, off you go and do 3 hours of music. So to keep us all on the same page, I think, you know, Joel Yarger just had a really consistent, very clear vision that we all stuck to. And I think he had an idea of the kind of music that he wanted us to work on. I mean, if you look at how the tracks are laid out on the soundtrack, like, Curtis is responsible for a lot of the choir stuff, like really the vast majority of it, especially the classical choir sounds. I'm responsible for quite a lot of the more aggressive banished Escherum style stuff, because there's a lot of overlap with the arc material. And you know, we all kind of dive into the legacy material, because Curtis got to do the monk's chant. I know he had the exact same thing as I did. I really love how he evolved it though, because it starts out like being you know, what we all know and love, and then he kind of takes it in his own direction. He got a license to really, really explore that and take it into a new place. And yeah, so I think Joel Yarger just like had an idea and what he wanted us to be assigned to. And then towards the end of production, we got onto the, you know, the final levels, specifically Silent Auditorium and the vast majority of that is what I would consider to be very new sounding material in the Halo universe. The tracks are Silent Auditorium, Endless Judgment, like they're all kind of like one big suite of music. That's where we're using Bulgarian choir instead of traditional choir, and then there's just a lot of synths, and it's a very different sound to the rest of the soundtrack. And I had great fun doing all of that stuff for the Endless, and the Harbinger, who is like another antagonist character who is introduced at the end, nearer the end of the game.
Yeah, the game is, it's kind of open-ended because all of a sudden there are these other... there's more.
I mean, the hint's in the title, right? It is called Halo Infinite, so there's the, you know, I don't think it's much of a stretch to suggest that there's going to be more down the line. But yeah, that kind of gives you an idea of like how we broke it up. And we never really worked on each other's cues that much. We did kind of borrow like motifs or themes, like, you know, I came up with the Escherim theme, and that was obviously, you know, if Joel Korolitz was doing another Escherim themed track, he would obviously use that theme. And, you know, we take a listen to each other's production choices to make sure that we're, you know, kind of like on the same wavelength. But yeah, we didn't really work on each other's tracks. So I think it's testament to Joel Yager's music supervision abilities that the score sounds as consistent as it does.
Yeah, absolutely. I've talked with Mike Salvatore about the music for Destiny, and he said the thing that is really important for him is for each track to have enough what he calls Destiny gravy. And they give like a bucket of themes to the composers that are working on whatever the expansion is. And did you guys have that too? Kind of a... you could cherry pick themes, or did that just sort of happen kind of organically?
I would say it happened organically because Joel Yager kind of like assigned us, Gareth, you're going, time to come up with the Escherim theme. That's your job. Like that was my thing. And, Curtis did a lot of the explorations with Cortana, who's a pretty key character in this game. I mean, all the Halo games really, but in this game in particular, And then it was, right, Gareth, now you're going to do the Harbinger stuff. It seems like I just got assigned with all the villain stuff, basically. gradually the theme bucket grows. And of course, we've got all of the themes from Halo 1, 2, and 3 to draw on. But Joel was adamant that we weren't just going to be dropping those in randomly. Like, we're going to, you know, have them and use them, but change them a bit or combine them with the themes that we're already using. I mean, the Escherim boss fight, it's a mix of the dun-dun-dun and then Escherim's theme, ba-da-da-dun, bum. Like, those two motifs are basically dueling each other throughout the Escherim boss fight track. And it's just like those, it's, you know, this is composition 101 to me, like combining themes. It's very obvious stuff to do, but surprisingly few games do it. I wish more games used their themes in more ways. And so, yeah, we did have this theme bucket, but it wasn't just like, yeah, drop the theme and then move on. It was like, okay, we have it. Can we change it a little, make it a little bit different? Changing a theme can be as simple as just putting it in a different instrument, but it can also be changing the rhythm, changing one note of the melody. There's so many different ways you can change a theme. I think I've kind of proven that over the years with my Ori and Arc. Like, I've, you know, it's, but to me, it's like basic composition. If you have a good theme, do not be afraid to use it. And it's the, I think I've talked about this before as well. Like, it's okay to have repetition if the initial material is good and you are smart enough about changing it in a slightly different way. You know, I mean, the Monk theme is a great example. Like, it sounds great no matter what instrument you put it in because it's a great theme. So why not explore and put it in the basses? Because then it sounds ominous, but you recognize it because it's still the Monk theme. Put it in the high violins because then, you know, and play it like with the mutes and softly. And then you've got like that lovely theme, but it can take on a very different emotion when played with a different instrument in a different way.
Well, and that theme in particular is so great because you don't even have to use the whole thing. Yep. You can just use a tiny, tiny fragment.
Yeah, you can use the initial leitmotif or you can use the whole thing.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. You mentioned that you did recording at Air, and that's fantastic. I mean, I'm wondering if COVID threw up any, you know, surprises, because it seems to have done that for a lot of projects.
So yeah, the first recording for Halo took place 2 weeks. It took place in between my two sessions for Ori and the Will of the Wisps, just to give you an idea of timeline. So that was a very, very crazy time for me. Then the second recording session took place in Nashville. That was largely due to COVID reasons. So, you know, it's not ideal to record stuff in a different studio, but we clearly made it work. And then the third recording session took place early last year, and London had opened up by then. So first recording session was not affected by pandemic. Second was, but we were able to record most of it with an aspect of social distancing. And it was the same with the third recording as well. So engineers, while everyone was locked down, basically figured out, like, okay, well, when we reopen, which is going to happen at some point, we are probably still going to need to socially distance. So how can we set up a recording profile with the correct microphones that will actually work in all of these rooms? And, you know, they weren't just sitting down doing nothing for like 2 to 3 months. They were ready to go, like, once the studios reopened and have like a setup that they were fairly confident would work and pick up all the instruments. Now, there are a couple of like downsides on the musician side. So when you're socially distanced and sitting, I think it's 1.5 meters apart, maybe it might have even been two, it's apart. If you've ever been to a classical concert or seen a recording session, especially the strings, they sit quite closely together because they need to hear each other's tuning. That's obviously harder when you're sitting, you know, a couple of meters apart. But these musicians are so good that they are able to adapt pretty quickly to the tuning needs, and just, you know, they just make sure that they're listening slightly more carefully. One of the benefits about recording in a studio as good as Air is it's going to sound good no matter what, because it's such an amazing acoustic. So yeah, we just had to, you know, kind of find the right settings for the microphones, and it's and just make sure that they're in the right place. And then it's kind of up to the engineer, both the recording engineer and the mix engineer, to dial in the sound that the composers and the music supervisor and 343 are looking for. So I'd say, honestly, the biggest bummer about the pandemic is that we weren't able to go to the recordings. We had to do them all remotely. Because travel was shut down. But we were still able to do them remotely for the second and third recordings. The first recordings we were able to go to, so I did have that once. But yeah, second and third were just never going to happen. So we did do them remotely, got up at crazy early times because Britain is 8 hours ahead. But the recording remotely is pretty much seamless these days. Like, I would say you only lose about 5% of the time due to, you know, just an extra layer of communication being needed. So getting everything done was not really a problem. And then, yeah, the recording setup, well, clearly everything worked because the soundtrack's production quality is very high. So, we were able to make it work. I have recorded on several projects since, both Abbey Road and Air, and done it socially distanced. I have a recording next month, which looks like it won't be socially distanced for the first time. Very excited about. The music recording industry appears to have navigated its way through the pandemic, and I'm just happy because video games have actually been able to keep recording musicians employed, because it has actually been, I would say, for at least the last year, maybe a year and a half, business as usual, to be honest, in terms of recording, which is really nice.
Well, I know a lot of you and Austin and Jason Graves and so many friends that I have in the music industry, they use musicians who aren't anywhere near, like Kristen Negus, who's in Florida, and she seems to have been able to provide whatever you guys need. And I'm sure you've got a whole stable of musicians that can work remotely.
We all have a big black book, and it's honestly a shared black book, I think, at this point, because, you know, we all ask each other all the time, like, hey, do you know such and such a person who can play such and such an instrument? I mean, of course, I mean, it's pretty much a meme at this point that Kristen is like, if you're doing video game woodwinds, you hire Kristen because then you'll win awards. That's pretty much it's pretty much what happens at this point. We all keep a, you know, a black book of, you know, it's not just the instruments available, it's like, how quickly can you turn it around, and like, is the recording set up good? Because I mean, that's a big part of it, you know Kristen's recording is always when I get a recording back from Kristen, I get the files and I just drag and drop it and it's basically done, like no editing required. It's basically add reverb and I'm done, that's it. I can just move on. It's fantastic, and it's how it should be. So yes, performing musicians, if you are working for a composer, they want the files to just literally be able to be dropped in with zero editing, like super clean. That's how it should be. And then you get hired again and again and again and again. We have a nice roster of musicians. And the great thing about being able to record remotely, I mean, there's plugins now for music software where I can talk to Kristen in real time and she'll record her end and it will go directly into my music software over the internet. Wow. Yeah, I mean, that literally exists now. And I can give her feedback like in real time. I don't do that. I like to leave her to do her own thing. But, you know, should I want to be more hands-on with another musician, I could totally do that and just get everything communicated in real time. I think one of the, you know, I try to look at silver linings. I mean, one of the benefits of the pandemic is, you know, people have found technological solutions to actually bring us closer together. Zoom basically didn't exist before the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here we are talking on Zoom. But that, you know, that extends to multiple industries and, you know, just the way we work as well. So, yeah, it's easier than ever to find musicians to record at a really high quality, which is great for composers.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I know you work so hard to be really organized and pay attention to all of the details so that there aren't any surprises along the way. And I'm just wondering if there were any surprises with this project.
I think the thing that I was surprised about most, honestly, was how much I got to explore with the end, the close of the game, all of the endless material in Silent Auditorium, because it was such a departure from what I'd done in the rest of the game, with all of the heavy percussive tracks and all of the, you know, more traditional Halo material. And then Joey Arger was like, all right, just not do whatever you want, but like, if you're going to start exploring more experimental territory, this is the time to do it. And I remember sending off, because it was so different, and I was so in, like, traditional Halo mode, I was like, okay, all right, I'm going to send this off. And I was like, there's no way he'll approve this. And then it was approved. And I was like, oh, okay, well, that's the direction we're going, huh? it's nice because it's kind of a little hint of, you know, what's to come. I'm particularly proud of the Endless music because, you know, I wasn't sure about the use of Bulgarian choir either, because again, it's just a departure from like the general sound of the game. And you know, when we recorded it, I was like, oh man, this really works very, very well. Yeah, it was just nice because it's kind of a hint of what is potentially to come. And I also feel that it was my opportunity to like put truly my own stamp on the game. Like, I think if you listen, especially to Silent Auditorium, like that's clearly Gareth Coker. Like that, you know, Silent Auditorium and Endless and Judgment, like that's clearly like my signature. Like the sounds are very layered. There's tons of reverb everywhere. You know, it's my aesthetic, but in the Halo universe. So it's kind of nice to put my own stamp on things. I was just surprised that I was able to do it because it hadn't been the case at that point. Like they kept us on the straight and narrow Master Chief discipline Halo music path, and then you know, those last few tracks for the closing segments of the game, we kind of got to do my own thing for that. But in terms of the overall production, I mean, it was actually, I know everyone talks about the year-long delay, but it didn't really affect music that much. Like, the year delay was largely for polish. Like, the campaign story didn't change that much. It didn't affect music in a way that we needed to do any rewrites. So I would say, like, from a music standpoint, and given collaboration and the pressure, honestly, like, because it's such a big franchise, that was the biggest surprise, is that it was smoother than I expected.
That's the best kind of surprise.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm not sure we've ever talked about this before, but I'm really curious. You know, this obviously, it was really important for you to be part of this project, and I wonder if you've got any, I don't know, advice or experiences you can share with composers who might be listening, who are wanting to audition for a, you know, a game that's really important to them. You know, what were some of the things that you thought about that you wanted to include in your audition, basically?
I mean, I think the thing that's going to get you noticed for a project of this scope, the first thing you actually have to do, and this is so important, it's actually the thing that's easiest to forget. The most attractive thing to people who are hiring is, what have you finished? Like, what have you actually shipped? Like, what can I listen to now? Don't tell me what you're working on 2 years from now. Like, show me what you have done, and preferably part of like a big project. So Curtis is actually a fantastic example, right? Because, you know, I don't think it's unfair to say that, you know, he's, you know, relatively new, right? But he shipped a title, and it's a big title with a lot of music, Starbound, and it's got a very unique sonic signature. And I think that was probably enough for Joey. I only shipped one game, he can ship another. Like, the amount of music is going to be no problem for Curtis. He's a very well-trained composer. Like, it's going to be assumed that you're well-trained. It's going to be assumed that you can write good music. So The one of the main differentiators is, have you actually finished and shipped a project? You've probably spoken to, well, I know you've spoken to countless composers over the years. The hardest thing to do is get a project over the line. Like, every composer will tell you how difficult it is to, like, literally finish a game. It is so hard. And if you're doing that, and if you have, like, a big, long list of titles that you shipped and the music is of high quality, you're going to get noticed. I think Curtis is an absolutely wonderful example of that, because most people would be like, wow, he's gone from Starbound to Halo. And he would tell you this himself. Like, you know, I don't think I'm saying anything unfair here. And I think that's also a testament to Joe Yaga's, you know, hiring. He's not just looking at the resume, it, you know, a list of big blockbuster titles. You know, it's like, can you ship something? And then does it have a unique signature? And I think that's the other thing, you know, finishing work, but like, this is kind of an annoying thing to say, because you'll hear it in like literally every composer advice ever. Be your own unique voice. But what does that really mean? To develop your unique voice, you have to write a lot of music. And one of the mistakes that young composers make, including myself, is trying to sound like the current trend rather than like just doing their own thing. And one of, you know, one of the things that can end up happening, like Dune just came out. And so what's going to happen now? For the next 3 to 4 years, we're going to have a bunch of sci-fi soundtracks with wailing vocals on top. Like, and that's not a problem, but like, it's just going to sound like budget Dune. Because no one's going to, literally no one will have the budget that Hans had for the Dune soundtrack. No one. It's just not happening. So what you should actually look at when listening to Dune is, why do people feel what they feel when they listen to the Dune soundtrack? And how can I do that so it doesn't sound like Dune? But I guarantee you, in the next 2 years, we're going to have a bunch of science fiction soundtracks or even fantasy soundtracks with like very specific vocal style. It's coming. Just like we had people try to copy Inception every so often, and like or American Beauty, every so often an iconic score comes along and it just becomes the de facto temp music that everyone's trying to copy. Now, look, you can do what you want as a young composer. I'm not going to stop you. But my advice, and you can take it or leave it, is to not do that. Like, take a listen to it, be inspired by it, but don't try and be someone else, because you're always going to be the B version of that person. But listen to it, take aspects of it that you like, and maybe try and infuse a bit of it into your own music. And that's how you develop your own original voice, or at least one part of it. But the other key is, the more music you write, the more experience you will have in writing your own voice. So you have to, if you're not on a project, you kind of have to find a way to get motivated just to write more music. And, you know, whether it's doing a, you know, just putting out an album out there, whether it's doing video game music covers, whether it's going and working on a mod project for a while that gives you a platform to write a lot of music, because then you'll know what you like writing, what you don't like writing. I mean, people ask me all the time about my Ori style. I don't know how it developed. I just wrote a ton of music, and that's what I wrote for Ori, what I thought sounded good. I can get into the science and the theory of it, but most of my choices when I'm composing, Halo accepted actually, because it wasn't my musical DNA. But when it is my musical DNA, I go on instinct. But that instinct is built up over hours and hours and hours of composing. Like, I mean, just look at my discography. I've written a lot of music. Even before like Ori came out, I'd written a lot of music. And so developing your unique voice is just something that is a byproduct of time and writing a lot of music.
Well, I would imagine if you're writing an audition piece, there's a kind of some guesswork involved too, because at the point where most composers would like to be brought onto a project, there's not a lot there. There's some concept art maybe and a sheet with the story, but that's about it. So you really have to kind of use your imagination and maybe kind of second guess what you think they want.
So the big tip I would give for an audition, just for a specific audition, because my last bit of advice was more general. If you have a specific audition, your goal is to not really, like, they're going to give you a bunch of briefs and like, you know, we wanted to sound like fantasy classical orchestra or whatever, you know, and don't feel you have to pay attention to that. Your goal is to make the person feel something they haven't felt before. That's how, in my opinion, you win a pitch. Now, obviously, it's got to be stylistically, don't do a sci-fi thing for a fantasy like project, obviously. It's obviously got to be in the ballpark stylistically. But your goal is to like not create the, if you're doing a pitching for a fantasy project, you know, you're not trying to create the greatest fantasy piece ever written. You're just trying to make the person feel something that means that they can't disassociate your music with their project. You want them to feel an attachment to their project and your music that they cannot separate. Then you will win the pitch. But that's easier said than done, because that, again, comes from instinct and it comes from taste. Like, your taste just might not match the thing that you're pitching for. And you just kind of have to live with that. I pitched for I pitched for a fantasy project a few years ago. And another composer got it, and I was like, wow, I thought I would have been a great fit for this project. But then the game came out and I was like, I heard the music and I was like, oh, it totally works. And I actually wouldn't have done that anyway. So, you know, it's fine. Like, so their taste, like what they wanted, wasn't matching like my instinct and taste. And I think I used to worry about losing pitches, but like clearly that one was never meant to be. And so you just kind of have to move on, because you only need one where the tastes are in perfect sync. and then you get an Ori. Like, you know, so like that's, you know, don't feel that you have to win every pitch, like, to just, and don't, because when you do that, you just try to write and pretend, like, think that you're writing something that's going to please the client. When you do that, you're not really being yourself. You're just kind of being, I can't put this any other way, you're basically a monkey on a treadmill just trying to please someone else. Rather than, you know, this is an art-focused job. So be an artist and present yourself, like, your best vision for the project. And if it doesn't match theirs, life will go on. Like, you know, it just wasn't meant to be. That's easier said than done, especially when you're, like, wondering where the next gig is going to come from. But I promise you, that's kind of, like, what you want, like, going into your, you know, into your future jobs. It's much better to be aligned with someone, because creatively then you end up delivering something really, usually really special when your tastes and vision are aligned.
Oh, absolutely. I feel like we've just had a tiny micro GDC session just right here.
Yes.
So great. Well, Gareth, it's been so much fun to talk with you. And I love the music that you wrote for Infinite. It's just,
thank you.
It's like, oh, it's just great. So thank you so much for your time. This has been really, really fun.
Awesome. And yeah, like I said, it might be a while before you hear from me on the games front, at least, but I am right in the middle of recording the Arc animated TV show right now, which is 7 hours of music coming into the Arc universe, all recorded at Abbey Road. So yeah, it's without a doubt a massive undertaking, but I'm really enjoying it.
I can't wait to hear it.